This is Carl Bott and Ted Leidy. We want to invite you to our new show, Man Up, the fourth Thursday of each month, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM.
Man Up, 6 to 7 p.m., where we explore the lost art of being a man.
Spirits, cigars, and hit the ground running when you get up in the morning. That's what Man Up's going to be about.
Oh, don't forget motorcycles, guns, and hard work every day.
And those things that men talk about when women aren't around.
That's right. Even cooking sometimes.
Even cooking sometimes. People, places, and things.
Serving your family, your community, and your country.
Man Up. Fourth Thursday of each month from 6 to 7 p.m. right here on Free Fire Radio.
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
And so we got used to the idea that everything will always be peaceful and it's only bad people who start trouble. But in fact, it's the human condition that we just have to live with it, and it's how we deal with it that takes the measure of us as men and women and as a species.
This is your host, Scott Bertram. Welcome to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, part of the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. That was Michael Walsh, author of A Rage to Conquer, 12 Battles That Changed the Course of Western History. We'll hear more from Michael later on in today's program. First, we're joined by Dr. Bradley Watson. He is Associate Professor of Government at the Van Andel Graduate School of Government at Hillsdale in D.C. Dr. Watson, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me, Scott.
Appreciate your time. You were on our main campus in Michigan earlier this academic year, giving a presentation on progressive jurisprudence and the crisis of constitutionalism. And that's what our conversation will center on today. Let's begin by defining our term. How would you define progressive jurisprudence, especially in contrast to, say, a more traditional or originalist interpretation?
Yes, it's a good question. When the progressives came on the scene in the early part of the 20th century, they were actually very suspicious of the courts, as they saw them as conservatizing institutions, an institution that stood in the way of progressive change. But as we move toward the middle part of the 20th century and the composition of the courts, especially the Supreme Court, changed in the New Deal and post-New Deal era, we see courts becoming much more sympathetic to progressive purposes. And progressive jurisprudence itself becomes a kind of intellectual framework by which progressive policies can be either allowed or, in fact, required. And progressives, when they start to dominate courts, especially the Supreme Court, come to believe that all constitutional meaning exists only in history, you know, relative to our particular moment in history, with a sense of, you know, history that is going somewhere, history that's not just a record of past events, but a kind of progressive unfolding, if you will. So they start to reject fixed notions of natural rights or even ordinary common law principles, which for a long time had dominated the thinking of American jurists. And furthermore, an important part of this is they understand judges, courts, to become the engines of history, not Congress, not the states, not the people. In fact, when Congress, the states, or the people are not moving quickly enough toward progressive ends, courts can overrule them. And meanwhile, of course, courts start to mint new rights, whether, you know, pick your favorite or least favorite new right, whether it be the right to abortion, at least for a very long time, which existed in American law, or same-sex marriage. So they start to invent new rights to serve progressive ends, and old rights, including property rights, get forgotten because they're not fashionable among progressive elites who teach in the law schools, the people who educate the judges. So progressive jurisprudence is very much this notion that everything, including constitutional meaning, exists only in history to be determined by judges.
Can we identify any core principles or values that underpin a progressive constitutional interpretation, or is it simply about the ends that matter?
Well, there is a philosophical background to all of this, and I guess these are the origins of the principles, if you will, of progressive constitutional interpretation are there. What we see at the end of the 19th and early 20th century with the progressive revolution in American political thought is a reliance on the twin doctrines of social Darwinism and pragmatism. Progressivism, I think, is the politicization of these twin doctrines, and it's only when these doctrines start to take hold amongst legal thinkers and in, you know, the new law schools which are springing up in the early part of the 20th century. What do these doctrines or philosophical frameworks emphasize? Well, social Darwinism, of course, emphasizes evolution, the fact that nothing, including even human beings, never mind human-created institutions, is in a state of sort of fixity, but everything changes, evolves, grows to the next stage. And pragmatism, of course, emphasizes modern sort of scientific experimental methods. And again, judges are understood to be the ones who will force the evolutionary changes, who will force the experiments that the people themselves are not choosing. So I would say the ultimate principles are derived from these philosophic systems, social Darwinism and pragmatism.
You spoke in your lecture here in Michigan about the role of John Dewey in transforming the model of natural selection into a social science and contributing to this crisis. How would you lay that out for us, the role of John Dewey in all this?
Dewey was a very important progressive thinker, certainly, one who was influenced by both Darwinism and pragmatism, and he emphasized flux, the changeableness of all things, and the importance of experimental methods. And he did this in a lot of areas. His influence sort of seeped into, I would say, legal thinking, but he was centrally a writer about philosophy and education and all kinds of things that progressives started to fixate on in the 20th century. In fact, he insisted that even philosophy itself has to be reconfigured, that is to say, our entire philosophical outlook, to seek only the causes of change, the ways and means of bringing about change, not ultimate ends or purposes, not teleology, because he didn't believe there were ultimate ends or purposes. He does this in a lot of writings, so he starts to influence all aspects, I would say, of American intellectual life.
Something you touched on, too, is this question about whether progressives largely ignore the possibility of negative change in a society, whether all change is good, all change moves us forward. Do they consider the potential risks, the potential downsides?
That's a good question. The fact of the matter is they pretty much do, I think, ignore the possibility of negative change in society. That is up until the point when progressives themselves are no longer in charge. Then they start to worry about negative change. I mean, witness the Dobbs decision recently, a couple of years ago, from the Supreme Court, which essentially, said the right to abortion, which America had lived with for 50 years, was essentially made up. It was not in the Constitution. Now, all of a sudden, progressives became very worried about judicial supremacy, which they had embraced for three quarters of a century. It used to be conservatives that worried about that. Now progressives are worried about so-called judicial supremacy, when, of course, the Dobbs decision didn't assert anything like judicial supremacy. It just said this right is not in the Constitution, and it turned the matter back to the state. So they don't worry about negative change until they do, and when they do, it means they're not running things anymore.
Talking with Bradley Watson. He is Associate Professor of Government at the Van Andel Graduate School of Government at Hillsdale in D.C. about progressive jurisprudence and the crisis of constitutionalism. To the second part, this crisis of constitutionalism, what in your view constitutes this crisis? What do you see?
Yes, we've been in the midst, I think, of a crisis of constitutionalism for a very long time, at least ever since living constitutionalism started to dominate the thinking of judges. The idea that the Constitution is itself is this organic living thing that doesn't fix anything permanently. And when you think about it, this renders written constitutions nugatory. After all, written constitutions are designed precisely to limit certain things, to halt constitutional change outside of formal amendment. So progressive constitutionalism looks to change the Constitution as quickly as possible. People say it's hard to amend our Constitution. Well, that's true if you're talking about the formal amendment mechanism, but it's not functionally true. Why not? Because the Supreme Court amends the Constitution all the time. Mm-hmm. They do this under the guise of constitutional interpretation. As I mentioned earlier, they just invent wholly new rights that no one from the certainly the founding generation or even recent generations would have imagined. Or they limit old rights, or they invent a doctrine like, wall of separation between church and state, which is also not in the Constitution. And when they do this, they are functionally amending the Constitution on the basis that it has to live and grow and keep up with the times, and again, that the courts, the judges, are themselves the engines of this progress.
Talking with Dr. Bradley Watson from Hillsdale in D.C. about progressive jurisprudence and the crisis of constitutionalism. More next. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
But join me for the first Thursday of every month at 6 p.m. for my show, North State Now. In this one-hour show, we cover what's happening in the music scene, theater, food, and arts. We get in-depth interviews with local business owners, musicians, actors, and authors. Listen in, tune in, call in, participate. Win tickets to concerts and theater productions. It's a lot of fun, and believe me, it keeps us going. Join me, your host, Linda Bott, or North State Now, the first Thursday, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. Also streaming at KCNR1460.com.
Have you ever wanted to unlock your musical potential? Cascade Curations not only has great music, art, and fashion, we also offer fun and exciting music lessons for all ages and skill levels. Whether you dream of playing the piano, guitar, drums, or vocals, our instructors will guide you every step of the way. With flexible scheduling and personalized instruction, you'll be playing your own tunes in no time. Don't just listen to music, create it. Call or text us at 530-255-4855 to book your first lesson. Cascade Curations, where we believe anyone can learn to play their own song.
Hi, this is Chuck Kinney, owner of Shasta Gas Propane. Have you been affected by some of the recent changes in business ownership here in Shasta and Tehama counties? These changes follow a national trend where national companies buy up locally owned small family companies and change the culture and staff and pricing of their product. That has occurred here in the North State also. Three locally owned propane companies have been purchased by large national companies. If you're like me and you prefer to deal with locally owned companies, you may be interested to know Shasta Gas Propane, which has been around for 28 years, now has the third generation working in the company. For locally owned, family operated service and care, give us a call at 530-365-3793. Thank you.
John Cruz here with America Outdoors Radio. Be sure to tune in this weekend and catch the latest in fishing, hunting, conservation, and destinations. If you love spending time in the field or on the water or in the woods, you're going to love this show. It's America Outdoors Radio, the fastest growing outdoors radio show in the nation. Tune in Saturdays from noon to 1 p.m. on 96.5 FM and 1460 AM KCNR, your talk radio.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Continuing our talk with Bradley Watson, Associate Professor of Government at Hillsdale in D.C.'s Van Andel Graduate School of Government, talking today about progressive jurisprudence and the crisis of constitutionalism. Dr. Watson, if progressive jurisprudence is embraced and we sort of live under this idea of judicial subjectivity, how is it even possible? Is it possible to guard against outcomes that are merely reflections of the policy preferences of the judiciary?
Well, there's only one guard against this, I think, and that is what's known in legal circles as departmentalism. That is to say, vigorous pushback from other branches who, after all, are everyone in government is equally sworn to uphold the Constitution. This was Abraham Lincoln's position in the face of the Dred Scott decision, which held slaves to be property and limited the power of Congress, therefore, to constrain the institution. And Lincoln refused to accept this as a precedent or to enforce it when he became president. So executive non-enforcement of patently anti-constitutional Supreme Court decisions is one option. Congress can also limit the appellate jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. We have a lot of tools within the constitutional framework to push back against judicial subjectivity or to rein in judges. We are kind of afraid to use them because, of course, immediately progressive forces will claim that this is somehow undermining the rule of law, but mm-hmm. that confuses the opinions of the Supreme Court with the law. It says the opinions of the Supreme Court are the Constitution. That was not the framers' understanding. That was not Lincoln's understanding. That is very much an artifact of the shift in political thought in the 20th century when progressives, as I said, came to rely on the Supreme Court to do their bidding. So we need to push back against that. We need to have political actors who just say no.
Yeah, it seems that President Trump and the Trump administration 2.0 is more interested in asserting executive power. Congress, though, continues to lag behind. Is there any way to prompt Congress to act to reassert its congressional powers?
That's a very good question, and I think the short answer to that is we have to figure out a way to make it in the interests of members of Congress to do that. As Publius says in The Federalist, the interest of the man must be linked to the constitutional rights of the place. Members of Congress now understand themselves to be essentially ombudsmen. That is to mm-hmm. say, go-betweens working on behalf of their constituents to ameliorate the negative, sort of impacts of the vast administrative state, the bureaucracy that Congress itself has created. So they do a lot of constituency service. They don't think in sort of high constitutional terms anymore. That is a tricky question, how to get them to do that. But clearly the branch that is most interested in pushback right now, as you note, is the executive branch. We have a very energetic president now who realizes there is something rotten with this state of judicial supremacy on a lot of fronts, actually.
Bradley Watson with us. Dr. Bradley Watson, Associate Professor of Government at the Van Andel Graduate School of Government at Hillsdale in D.C. on progressive jurisprudence and the crisis of constitutionalism. Are there democratic risks if the courts become the primary agents of constitutional change or evolution, as you laid out before, rather than the people themselves?
Yeah, I mean, again, according to the Federalist, courts are the least Republican branch by design. So when they become the primary agents of constitutional evolution, it ends up destroying the most fundamental natural right of all, when it comes to politics at least, that is the right of consent to government. Lincoln again says, laments the fact that the people will cease to be their own rulers if they put government in the hands of what he says is that eminent tribunal. And again, in response to the world that was created by the Dred Scott decision, he said, The people still rule in America, and we cannot turn ourselves over to the diktat of judges when they're acting patently outside of normal constitutional understandings and of the sort of natural rights framework of the Constitution.
Kind of a bigger picture question, perhaps. Progressives, could they get to their goals? Could they achieve the goals through originalist methods? Or is progressivism and what they want to accomplish inherently incompatible with the idea of an originalist interpretation of the Constitution?
I know. I mean, sure, many progressive policy goals could be achieved within constitutional bounds. That, I think, is not controversial. In fact, it's just called legislation, right? Mm-hmm. Or if there is some, hard constitutional limit that stands in the way of what the American people want, it's called constitutional amendment. But either of these things, both legislation and certainly constitutional amendment, formal amendment, tend to be viewed by progressives as too slow, too cumbersome. So some things, but the policy level, could be achieved through legislation, could be achieved through constitutional amendment, but certainly not all progressive goals, I think, could be achieved through originalist methods or in line with the Constitution. For example, things that deny the equal natural rights of human beings, mm-hmm. including consent, are always going to be unconstitutional in the American framework. The right not to be subject to arbitrary or invidious discrimination at the hands of government, that will always be unconstitutional. On the other hand, the right to life, to liberty, and estate are always going to be constitutionally protected. They can be deprived only with due process of law, yet the administrative state often circumscribes these things in the absence of the rule of law. So there's a deep sense, I think, in which the administrative state, bureaucratic rule, the deep state, whatever you want to call it, are permanently unconstitutional. So we have to get back to consensual government by law rather than agency fiat, and decisions that are made in the open with the consent of the governed rather than through opaque bureaucratic mechanisms.
One final question for Dr. Bradley Watson, because it is such a topic of conversation today. The plethora of nationwide injunctions on actions of the executive branch, the idea of a lower court justice offering these nationwide injunctions, does that fit inside the framework of what we're discussing today?
Yeah, very much. It kind of assumes the idea of judicial supremacy and that judges really do get to dictate the general policy of the nation. As I said earlier, Lincoln rejected that idea even when it was coming directly from the Supreme Court. Never mind, the Supreme Court is the only court that is federal court that's demanded by the Constitution. All other federal courts are creatures of statute. So Lincoln rejected it from the only constitutional court, and now, lower-level statutory courts, trial courts, are issuing these injunctions everywhere all across the fruited plain in an attempt to set the national policy direction of the country. We can't function on that basis. Court decisions should bind the parties to the decision, but under, I think, false notions of judicial supremacy, we've long accepted the idea that courts get to bind everyone, including the political branches, even lower courts. This is very, very far outside the framers' understanding of what common law courts would do.
Dr. Bradley Watson is Associate Professor of Government at the Van Andel Graduate School of Government in Hillsdale, in D.C., talking today about progressive jurisprudence and the crisis of constitutionalism. Dr. Watson, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Up next, Michael Walsh joins us. His new book, A Rage to Conquer, 12 Battles That Changed the Course of Western History. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
This summer, stack the deck in your favor with a night of music, laughter, and Broadway magic with the Shasta College summer musical comedy, Guys and Dolls. Be enthralled by the talents of over 30 singers and actors as they bring this Tony Award-winning classic to life with unforgettable songs, dazzling dancing, and fast-paced fun the whole family will enjoy. Evening performances run July 18th through the 26th, with two matinees on July 20th and 27th, and a special ASL show on July 24th at the Shasta College Theater in Reading. Tickets are $20 for general admission, $15 for seniors and just $5 for students. Reserve your seats now at shastacollege.edu/artsevents. Have some cool family fun this summer with the classic and affordable live orchestra musical Guys and Dolls. Get your tickets today. See you at the show.
Hi friends, RC here with Tobacco and Brew, bringing you this month's Cigar of the Humidor. Aksum, Ecuadorian Sumatra wrapper, Connecticut broadleaf binder, Nicaraguan filler, and ultimately a masterpiece cigar from the A.J. Fernandez factory. Complexity defines this stick. Notes of black pepper, cocoa, hickory, and nutmeg. Get yours today at Tobacco and Brew, Redding, California.
As we all get older, the one constant thing is the aggressive, excessive mail and advertising for Medicare, Medicare supplements, and Medicare Advantage. And almost every one of them is a call center with no idea of what you really need. Siskiyou Insurance has an agent that deals with nothing but Medicare issues and can explain the differences clearly between a Medicare supplement and Medicare Advantage. Call Greg Green at Siskiyou Insurance at 530-224-2345 or 1-800-773-2345.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Obtaining a California concealed weapons license will allow the licensed individual to transport a listed handgun in their vehicle or on their person in public. For application instructions, training, and other information, contact NFI at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and remember, it's our right and our responsibility.
If you're tired of artificial intelligence and dishonest news, tune in to Poke the Hornet's Nest every other Sunday at 8 a.m.
Join Nick Gardner and Doug Janke, two hosts who were educated at School of Hard Knocks. Get a layman's view of local government as well as our take on national and world events.
If you're woke, go back to bed. You won't like us.
This show's for educated voters, not for people that voted for Kamala Harris.
Tune in to Poke the Hornet's Nest
every other Sunday, 8 a.m. here on KCNR1460.com, 96.5 FM, and 1460 AM.
Alan Gordon, Coachmaster Collision. Although Coachmaster is recognized as the authority and specialist in frame and suspension, we are primarily your auto body and truck collision repair center. This includes all vehicles, Lexus, Honda, or pickup trucks. Our technicians are highly trained and have the most advanced equipment to ensure a complete and quality repair. With our knowledge and the insurance claim process, all we need is your claim number to handle your claim. Coachmaster has a great working relationship with all insurance companies. This ensures a complete repair with quality parts and a delay-free process. At Coachmaster, in our 50 years in business, we've experienced almost every situation imaginable in a claim. This experience and personal dedication to the repair of your vehicle sets Coachmaster apart from all other choices. And yes, if we can't fix it, no one can.
Learn more online at CoachmasterAutobody.com.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to check out the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. You'll find older episodes of this program, plus all sorts of other outstanding Hillsdale audio, like Imprimis, The Larry Arn Show, the Hillsdale College Online Courses Podcast, podcast.hillsdale.edu, or wherever you find your audio. We're joined by Michael Walsh. He's the author of Last Stands and more than 15 other novels and nonfiction books. The newest one is called A Rage to Conquer, 12 Battles That Changed the Course of Western History. Michael, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, it's a real pleasure to be back with you, Scott, and to be able to speak to all my friends at Hillsdale.
A wonderful place, and we thank you for your support and visits through the years, too. Michael, this book is about war. And you make a point very early on that I don't think had ever been put this way that I saw. War is a primary engine of both scientific and cultural progress. That's not the way most people think about war. Why perhaps should we consider it from that angle?
Well, I would go back to what I wrote in Last Stands, Scott, because this book is a sort of knock-on from that book, which pointed out via Immanuel Kant that war is the natural state of humanity and that peace is the aberration. So we have this notion after World War II, and the boomer generation, of which I'm a proud member, grew up effectively in a world that had settled its conflicts. Now, we did have the threat of nuclear war, and we were ducking under our desks in the 1950s, et cetera, but there hasn't been a global conflict since 1945. And so we got used to the idea that everything will always be peaceful, and it's only bad people who start trouble. But in fact, it's the human condition, and that's the conclusion of the book, too, that we just have to live with it, and it's how we deal with it that takes the measure of us as men and women and as a species. But it drives almost all technological change, because when you're in an existential situation, you reach for any weapon that comes to hand, even when you have to invent it. So we did, for example, with the atomic bomb in World War II, in order to end World War II as quickly and as bloodlessly, believe it or not, as possible, which we did. And from that technology has grown a host of good things. But it's like the people who complained about horse manure in New York City, which used to pile up in 8-foot piles. And then when the motor car came, it was hailed as something that was a non-polluting way to get around the city. Now, of course, you know, their descendants think that the motor car is polluting, and they'd probably like to have us back to horses. But it's easy to forget how easily things change under pressure, or how quickly they change under pressure. And then we take for granted the technological advances that happened and congratulate ourselves on our own virtue.
You also say that wars are not ended at the bargaining table. Those are face-saving maneuvers after a win or a loss. So if wars are not ended by talking, how do our wars end?
Well, they end the way all wars do, with the other side completely, totally, and utterly defeated. That is to say, there is no fight left in them, and there may not even be any of them left at all. I have a saying in the book, if you're negotiating, you're losing. No winner negotiates a victory. Only a loser negotiates the terms of surrender. And that goes all the way back to siege warfare in the classical era. That is to say, under Alexander and Caesar, and I devote two long chapters in A Rage to Conquer to both Alexander at the Battle of Gaugamela and Caesar against the Gauls in the Battle of Alesia. You fight to win, and winning is the only acceptable outcome. Negotiation is for losers.
A Rage to Conquer reminded me, Michael, in the best of ways, of Victor Davis Hanson's recent book, The End of Everything, where he talks about these battles that ended in the destruction of a civilization. Is that catastrophic defeat that we see in some of these battles in your book and in Victor Davis Hanson's book, is that more the nature of things than anything else through history?
Yes, it is. Most classical battles were over in a day. One of them, famously, Cannae, ended with the slaughter of all the Roman legions that were fighting against Hannibal. So some number between 50 and 75,000 men. Now, that ended that battle, and Hannibal roamed up and down the Italian peninsula for literally years afterwards. But one of the survivors at Cannae turned out to be a man later on known as Scipio Africanus, because he's the one who chased Hannibal down in the end and beat him at Zama many years later. So nothing is ever over, but Cannae was as close to over as you could get. All the other battles, the Battle of Antioch, for example, that I talk about in my chapter on Bohemond and the First Crusade, ended with the complete and total rout of the Muslim armies that had come to try to dislodge the Christians, having seized the city of Antioch, an ancient Christian city, we should remember. And that opened the way to Jerusalem. So these battles are pivotal, but the other side must know it has been defeated. And this was General Sherman's principle in the Civil War, which is the faster and bloodier it's over with, the the more humane it is, which seems contradictory, but it's not.
Michael Walsh with us, his new book, A Rage to Conquer, 12 Battles That Changed the Course of Western Civilization. You've said this a couple of times. A successful war is one that accomplishes its objective. There's so much talk today, Michael, about forever wars involving the United States. Is that because our objectives are not clear? Because as I heard someone say recently, it's not a forever war if you win. It's not a forever war if you achieve your objective.
Correct. We don't fight to win. The last chapter of this book, which is in large part on my website, the-pipeline.org, the-pipeline.org, is the afterword to this book, which has proven quite controversial, mostly because I say we no longer have objectives. It would be rude to have objectives. Mm-hmm. It would be rude to fight to win. That if you go into a fight looking for an exit strategy before you start, you have already lost the fight. So all we do is fight to lose, not even to tie, to lose, and then come home again. And, of course, the Biden administration, may it rest in pieces, is the worst manifestation of it because it just left the field, like cowards. And the result of it will be more dead Americans down the road. So we had, and we may still have, an opportunity to end a forever war, which is, by the way, against Iran, which, by the way, started this war in 1979 mm-hmm. with the seizure of the American embassy and the taking of the hostages, which lasted for well over a year until Ronald Reagan's inauguration. We have a chance to finish them. That is to say, what I've advocated is to regime change, absolutely. Why that's not an objective should be number one objective, regime change. Number two, deinstitutionalization of Islam. The Iranian people are great people. They are not Arabs. They were conquered by Arabs. They have had Arabic forced on them via the Quran, which could only be read in Arabic. Mm-hmm. They are a subject people of a formerly great civilization, and they have a chance to liberate themselves with Israeli and American help, and I hope they take it, because taking Iran out of the Ummah, the Islamic Ummah, and making it a stronghold of Indo-European civilization again, right in the middle of the most troublesome part of the world, would be the best possible outcome. But, of course, we probably won't be, because we'll stop fighting, we'll call for peace, and nothing will change, and we'll be back in the same place we started. I hope that doesn't happen.
That's Michael Walsh, his new book, A Rage to Conquer. More next. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
I'm Jack Potter, Jr., Tribal Chairman for Redding Rancheria. We've proudly partnered with the Redding Rodeo Association for Native American Appreciation Night. As you know, our roots and hearts are here in this community and are proud of this partnership. From grants to help local businesses and government, to making health care available to so many, to our own community events like the Stillwater Powwow that happens right here on this same land. Redding Rancheria is proud to play our part.
Join the heartbeat of our county every Monday at 6:35 a.m. on KCNR with the Town Hall Brief during the Sue McLean News Hour. Known for its unbiased reporting, the Town Hall Brief brings clear, local-focused updates and heartfelt discussions that unite our community. Got a story to share? Email townhallbriefs@gmail.com or connect via socials at Town Hall Brief on linktree.com to drop a DM. The Town Hall Brief. Your community's voice for Shasta County News, Monday mornings at 6:35 on KCNR.
Now is a great time to prepare for the upcoming wildfire season. REU and city staff are busy clearing vegetation to mitigate wildfire risk to our power lines, facilities, and the community. You can also prepare by trimming back shrubs and tree branches that are closer than 5 feet from your home. Clear debris from your roof and gutter and clear dead vegetation on your property. For information about tree trimming and proximity to power lines, call 530-224-4356. Please remember, we all need to work together to prevent wildfires in our community.
Get ready for the day with the Sue McLean News Hour on KCNR. Your weekday weather forecast, set you up to seize any moment, rain or shine. Brought to you by the Queen of Dragons, a value-driven local spot offering premium flower, edibles, and concentrates with free delivery to Shasta Lake. Their Flower Friday special lasts all weekend till supplies run out. Hurry over. Check them out on X, Facebook, or thequeenofdragons.com. KCNR keeps you in the loop every day.
Hi there. It's a sunny reminder from Alliance Heating and Air. Thinking about going solar? Now's the time to act. The 30% federal solar tax credit may be ending December 31st, 2025. But if you install your system soon, you could still save an average of up to $12,700. Don't wait. Call Alliance Heating and Air at 530-221-2642 to lock in your savings. We make it simple. We make it smart. And that's why everybody calls us.
Everybody calls us.
I'm Tracy Edwards, CEO of the Redding Rancheria. Giving back to our local community is a tradition that is firmly rooted in our history.
I'm Nathan with the Redding Trail Alliance, and we're here at the Redding Bike Park. We just want to thank the Redding Rancheria for all the help they've given us over the years supporting the many projects we're doing for our community.
Hi, I'm Dan, and this is Donna, and we're with Wings of Angels.
And we'd like to thank the Redding Rancheria for their continued support over the years to our foundation.
Redding Rancheria, proud to play our part.
We're back. Humbo Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to follow us on X. We're at Hillsdale Radio for updated show and guest information. And you can find more about our shows on the Hillsdale College Podcast Network at HC Podcasts on X. We continue our conversation now with Michael Walsh, his new book, A Rage to Conquer, 12 Battles That Changed the Course of Western History. Michael, you talk about presentism in the introduction, judging actions of the past by the standards of the present. This is a big problem in many areas. Why is it particularly dangerous when it comes to war?
Well, it destroys our willpower, as we've been talking about. The presentism is the doctrine, the academic. It's an academic thing. Let's start with that. So, only someone foolish enough to go to the Ivy League to get an education could believe in it. And what it says is we get to judge the past by the standards of the present. So Mao's Cultural Revolution was exactly that. That all of the Chinese past had to be destroyed in the name of the Great Cultural Revolution. What we just went on in America, through it here in America, disgracefully, was the COVID hoax, which was a hoax perpetrated with fascistic force on the American people. We had the Me Too Black Lives Matter destruction of whole industries. And the digging up of the past, as I've been saying in print for 50 years now, we have an urge, especially among the boomers like me, to dig up the past and hang it again. Because being dead isn't enough for us. We want to, like the British did to Cromwell's corpse, and may I say, as an Irishman, I'm all in favor of this, dig it up, behead it, throw it in a pit, and leave the head on London Bridge. That's presentism. Now, we have to be very, very careful of presentism because it immobilizes us, and that's why it's an academic doctrine, because the infiltration of the American universities, which is another whole problem, not at Hillsdale, thank God, is to make you, via the doctrine of critical theory, question everything about your past and trash it. And as you remember, I think you and I have talked about it, I wrote a book about this 10 years ago, called The Devil's Pleasure Palace, which is all about the intellectual history of the Frankfurt School and the beginning of the critical theory movement here in the United States. So that's what presentism is. It's just more critical theory, unfortunately.
Michael Walsh, A Rage to Conquer, 12 Battles That Changed the Course of Western History. I want to talk about a few of these battles in the time that we have left. 12 critical battles, the men behind them. Give the opportunity first to perhaps identify one of these battles maybe you learned the most in your research or perhaps are the most instructive for us. Which one would you pinpoint?
Wow, it's tough because obviously I chose the 12 very carefully. I would say one of the battles that nobody knows anything about that you can't make up that it actually happened is the chapter on Aetius, the last of the great Roman generals, versus Attila the Hun of all possible people, which was fought in France, sort of near Troyes, in the Champagne area where all these battles were fought. And it was the last stand of the Roman legions. Mostly they weren't Romans at this point. They were Visigoths, Christianized Visigothic allies, and a tribe called the Alans against Attila and his motley crew. In most of these battles, even in the Greeks in Alexander's time, you had people from the same, what today we would call country or ethnicity, fighting on both sides. So there were plenty of Greek mercenaries in the Persian forces when Alexander attacked. And at Degranicus, when he defeated them, he killed them all. They begged for mercy, he said, "You traitors," and he killed them all, which was an object lesson to everybody else. But the Catalonian Plains was a wonderful battle, beautifully executed by Aetius. And again, because you can't make this up, he actually was friends with Attila the Hun. They had grown up together. So it's almost like a Hollywood movie. That Aetius had been a hostage, which has a slightly different connotation to, for us today, be someone who's an unwilling captive, prisoner. In those days, warring or tribes living uneasily with each other would exchange royal or noble personages as hostages to ensure good behavior on the other side. That is, if one of you violated the treaty, you'd kill the king's son, for example, or the leader's son. So the Romans did this all the time. Aetius had been a hostage. He had grown up with Attila. He understood the Turkish, the Hunnish way of war, and the horsemen and the archers and all of their tactics, and he was able to stop them cold, just inside the borders of what's now today France. And I think that's a thrilling, thrilling story.
Michael Walsh, there's a chapter on Napoleon, and you say he is without peer, essentially, in his command of land warfare, and also his ability to know what the opponent is going to do before the enemy himself knew what he was going to do. How's that possible? How did Napoleon do that?
Right. Well, I would say that's the characteristic of every great general. So it's certainly true of Alexander, who knew what the Persians were going to do before they did it. In fact, he slept in on the night and the morning of the Battle of Gaugamela, according to the ancient historians. And when he was roused from bed, finally, by one of his lieutenants, he said, "Why are you bothering me? I have this completely under control." They were beat before we even started. And Napoleon also knew what the enemy was going to do. He just had a way of psyching them out. And he picked his battlefield terrains very, very carefully. One of the reasons he lost in Waterloo was it wasn't his terrain. And he made a big mistake in trying to go up that hill against the British-Dutch alliance under Wellington. But Patton had the same characteristic. And remember, Patton studied both Alexander and Napoleon greatly. So they just sense it. It's a sense of over a vast space, where is this army going? How can he move it? As I said in one of my speeches recently, both in Los Angeles and in Washington, D.C., the old saying is that amateurs talk tactics, professionals talk logistics. And that's the truth. It's easy for you to say, "Well, I would have moved the Third Corps over here." And Napoleon would have said, "Yeah, but the Third Corps is over there, and there's a river, and they're out of food. So how are you going to do that, genius?" You really have to know the whole sweep of the battlefield. The other point to make about Napoleon, why I admire Napoleon, is he is the first self-made man in Western history. He comes from absolutely nowhere, and he becomes the Emperor of France and the dominating figure for 10 years of European history, purely on his own initiative. Literally, he's Italian. He doesn't even speak French very well, never did. He's minor Italian nobility, only French by pure accident of the fact that Corsica had been given to France just a few years before his birth. His men loved him. He would get in the trenches with them. There wasn't anything he didn't know about this kinetic warfare. And he became a celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I've mentioned is he met with Goethe, for example, in the first decade of the 19th century, after his great victories at Austerlitz and at Jena. And they had a conversation, not about war, but about Goethe's novel, The Sorrows of Young Goethe, and drama. And Napoleon was terribly interested in that. He started out as a novelist. He wanted to be a novelist when he was a young man before his military career. And so he became this figure of iconography. He's instantly recognizable. And you know who takes after him? Not military commanders so much, but Lord Byron and Franz Liszt. In his immediate aftermath, you have two guys who are the same guy as Napoleon. They have a distinctive profile. Literally everybody knows them by sight. They don't even need passports. They can kind of go wherever they want to. They are the most famous people in the world. And Napoleon invented the cult of international celebrity, in addition to his military exploits.
Michael Walsh, the book, A Rage to Conquer, 12 Battles That Changed the Course of Western History. You can find it where you find your books, and also find him online, the-pipeline.org. Michael, thank you so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate it.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Dr. Bradley Watson from Hillsdale in D.C. and Michael Walsh, author of A Rage to Conquer. The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is recorded at the studios of WRFH, the student-run radio station at Hillsdale College. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu and now available on YouTube. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
I'm Steve Coburn, proud owner of Country Air Pet Resort here in Reading. I invite you to come and take a tour of my revitalized pet resort. Our goal here at Country Air is to make sure your pet can relax and have a healthy, happy time away from home. With friendly, caring people, lots of fresh air and exercise, good healthy food, and plenty of pampering. There are no small cages here. What we offer are large temperature-controlled runs and spacious exercise yards that are great for fun and socialization. We even offer daycare. Cats are treated to a two-room apartment plus playtime in our playroom. So stop by and take a tour of the best. You and your pet will want to come back to Country Air Pet Resort, where our motto is, we treat your pets as if they were our own. Country Air Pet Resort, 549-3335.
Hi, it's Mark from Haven Humane Society. Are you looking to add to your family? We have puppies, kittens, small critters, and farm animals. Each year we have thousands of amazing animals looking for homes come into our lives, and we hope to have them join yours. Follow us on social media and find our links on our website at havenhumane.org. Watch our weekly content on YouTube, like our Mark's Monday mashup, when we talk about what's going on and introduce you to our team and adoptable animals. Get involved. Volunteer. Thank you for all your continued support. Together, we are moving closer to our ultimate goal of a North State with no more homeless pets.
Summer travel is here, and it can be tough on a vehicle. Whether it's dust or dirt, pollution or road grime, stop by Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Market and Eureka Way in downtown Reading. They offer car wash packages starting at $11. Quick and Clean's gentle, automated pull-through wash includes a hand scrub pre-clean and a personal towel dry exit. Save money, save water at Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Market and Eureka Way in downtown Reading.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So, what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world: family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.